Hello and welcome to another edition of The White Women's Perspective. I'm Rachel Pendergraft.
And I'm Sherry Makings.
And we're here in the Ozarks. It's a beautiful afternoon and a lot of people here getting ready for the European American Heritage Festival in Pulaski. If you're listening to this, we hope that you're able to make it. We've never been rained out, and I know that all the different times you've been there, Sherry, we've always had really great weather. It's kind of like an Oktoberfest. The weather's great. It's, there's a lot to do there, just a lot of nice white people to sit and visit with. Anybody, I do want to say anybody that's planning to attend, bring your lawn chairs.
Right.
Because it is a festival. It's not like where there's like planned seating arrangements. Armchair, lawn chair, whatever you call it, camp chair, and bring it and just plan to hang out for the day and have a bowl of chili or some nachos or hamburger and listen to Heritage Connection Band and look at the White Heritage booths and visit with different people and everything. And you can go to whiteheritagefestival.com website if you want to get more information. But Sherry, we were talking just a little bit ago, you had made a recent trip up to Springfield, Missouri, and you kind of noticed some changes in the behavior. And we're not talking about the Uyghurs that
But
just in regard to the safety precautions that women are taking and moms are taking and so forth.
Right. You know, I don't go to malls, and when I did, I had the... When I first got there, I walked in and I had noticed a, of course, white mother grabbing her daughter, was probably between 12 and 14, and grabs this child by the hand and holds her close. And I thought, man, this kid must have got in trouble. Mm-hmm. And I kind of go on and did some quick shopping through all the mess there. And I've noticed that there were more parents with their white, mostly daughters, mm-hmm. and they were closer together. It wasn't like when we were kids and we all just hung out at the mall all day.
Right.
And I had noticed even more as people would leave a store or mostly leaving the outside of the mall, these mothers are holding these kids tight. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just one who might have been in trouble. There were numerous occasions where these girls are being held extremely tight to the adults that they're with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I'd forgotten about it, but when you mentioned that, I'd noticed the same thing myself the last time. Now, here in our area, we don't have, like, big shopping malls. It's a relatively rural area, so if we want to go out and do a big shopping spree at a big mall or something like that, then, you know, we'd drive about an hour to up to Springfield, Missouri, and get all of our shopping done there, maybe to Branson or something like that. But I had noticed, likewise, the last time I was up there, that when the mothers would, you know, be leaving the mall and walking out to the parking lot, even in the daytime, that they would have their daughters they'd be holding their hand. And at first that kind of seemed odd to me because, I mean, when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, my mom and I went shopping somewhere, she didn't hold my hand, and if she tried to, I'd be like, what the heck are you doing, you know?
You're hiding
from me. I'm a big girl, I don't need my mommy to hold my hand. But I thought it was interesting because the moms were holding their hands. The daughters looked like it was perfectly natural, and it looked like they were fine with it. And to me, it just showed a recognition that more and more parents are having about the safety issues regarding their daughters, for the most part their daughters, but sons too, in an increasingly violent world, non-white world and so forth, where young girls are being preyed upon. And it's really striking to see the change in behavior. I don't think it's undue paranoia. You know, I know there's the helicopter parents were like, oh, you know, the parents are, they're just, you know, putting too much caution upon their kids. And you know, back in my day, kids just ran out and played whenever they wanted. As long as they were home by dark, didn't matter, you know, where they were, what they were doing for the most part. It was just considered that they were going to be safe. And I know there was, remember that last year there was that lady, I want to say Massachusetts, maybe it wasn't, but it was somewhere in that neck of the woods. And she was an older mother, and I mean older mother as in she was probably like 50 or something, and her child was, I think, 5 or 6. And several people had called the cops on her because she had let this, I think it was a 5-year-old girl, walk home from school by herself, a couple miles, and go to the park and hang out by herself. And she was saying that, well, you know, how dare people get upset about it? This is the, you know, people are extra paranoid. They're too paranoid. Most kids aren't abducted. You know, it makes kids not learn how to rely on themselves and things like that. And everybody goes back to that, you know, like Leave It to Beaver, Andy Griffith type era.
Right.
Where, you know, like, and that's how it was when I was a kid. It's like, you know right from wrong, and you know when it gets dark, so be home when it's dark.
Right,
know,
right, right.
Type deal. But, I mean, nowadays, I think you do have to be careful. And it's not like everybody is out targeting kids, but I think there's enough of it that I think people
But they are
careful.
Targeting kids.
They are.
Yeah, they have to be. I mean, if they're not careful, who's going to be?
Right.
You don't want to be the mom sitting at home going, oh, if I would have only held her hand one time.
Right, right, absolutely. And, you know, and we've seen more, you know, cases where, you know, it's not just someone going out to the store or parking lot in the middle of the night, in the dark, in a bad area of town that are targeted. It's in a multiracial society. People are being targeted in the middle of the daytime.
Yeah, this was 11 o'clock in the morning in the
yeah,
middle of
right.
Missouri. I mean, who would have thought? And,
right.
And they are. They're holding on to them like they were being stalked.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that it's sad because on one standpoint, it's sad that the parents have to feel that way. But
right.
On the other side, it's good that they're being extra watchful, I think, of the children
right.
or the young adults, adolescents, whatever. You know, any 15-year-old girl that's listening to this is going to be like, don't call me a kid, so I won't. But young women, you know.
Right, right.
The young women of that age, I think they appreciate knowing that their moms and their dads care about them. And
openly, it's embarrassing,
yeah.
But inside they know that they get to be home safe every night.
Right.
Because what happens when they're taken is the scary unknown.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it's good because if this is kind of instilled into them that they need to always be careful of their surroundings, especially, you know, when they go off to college.
Oh, definitely.
They have to be extra vigilant about their surroundings. And I know, actually, Rolling Stone magazine, they're being sued right now for incorrectly doing a story on an alleged rape at a frat house and so forth. And I won't get into all the details and so forth. It ended up that the story turned out to be basically not true. But the story had highlighted what they called a rape culture on college campuses, and a lot of people are fighting back against that terminology and saying it doesn't exist and we're unfairly characterizing young men and so forth. And we both have, you know, sons and so forth, and so we don't want young men to be unfairly characterized as being caught up in a rape culture. But we're seeing a multiracial climate in cities and in college campuses. And that doesn't mean that all rapists and sexual assaults are at the hands of non-whites, but when you degrade society as a whole and lower society and lower its morals and so forth, then you lower everyone's morals, and that includes white and non-white.
Right.
But, you know, a large, and I would say majority of the, you know, sexual assaults and rapes on campuses are at the hands of non-whites. But regardless, you know, these mothers that were holding their daughter's hands, I think that's teaching them a valuable lesson that they need to be, you know, always vigilant about their surroundings, and especially when they go off to college, because, you know, they're in this environment where it's, you know, they're out from under parental supervision. the overall college structure, just, you know, the freedom and liberty is, you know, just unheralded in, you know, the world's history. I mean, just do what you want, go where you want, say what you want.
It always looks like that free love Berkeley campus.
It's like never ending. And that can get people into a lot of trouble and get them into circumstances that on the surface just seem like fun, young, adult type party behavior, but can have really devastating circumstances.
And they don't realize they're in that until they're too far into it.
Right, absolutely. But one thing that I did notice that more women are becoming aware of is, and apparently some reporters too, is the upsurge of rapes and sexual assaults all across Europe. Even in some of the refugee camps, there's a story that, remember that story we were looking at the other day? There was a news team. There's a woman, she was a 38-year-old woman. Now, she's originally from Afghanistan, but she's living in Europe now. And she went to a refugee camp at Calais with a TV crew, and she was going to act as an interpreter. And this refugee camp, the people there are getting ready to come to the UK. So they were there to talk to and interview people at this refugee camp about their lives and about basically their hopes and dreams as they go to the UK, the United Kingdom.
Right.
And they got attacked. And the cameraman was attacked, and she was, like, raped, gang raped.
Yeah, just thrown down right there. It wasn't hauled off or anything. It was just viciously done.
It was just
done.
We're not even going to try to hide and take you somewhere else. We're just, you know, this is what we do. And she was, like, viciously raped. And what struck me was that these are people that the next day were going to the UK.
Yeah.
You know.
They were fixing to ship them out, put them into general population. But, hey, before we go, let's just ruin somebody else.
Right. And, you know, they probably will end up in the UK because they didn't catch the guys.
Right. Yeah. They said that they were looking into it. Right. They were trying to find something through DNA.
Right.
Like they register before they hit these camps.
Yeah, right. So there's like 10,000 people at some of these refugee camps. They're all getting ready to go into the UK. There's been, we don't have it here, but there was a story that, actually the trial just ended last week in the UK, and it was about a 13-year-old girl who was gang raped over the course of 2 or 3 years by a Middle Eastern Asian gang. And you say, well, how can someone be gang raped over 2 or 3 years? Well, it's because they intimidated her and told her they were going to burn her family's house down, they were going to rape her mom, they were going to kill her, they were going to kill her brothers and sisters, they were going to kill her family. And the viciousness that they had attacked her in at the very first attack, trying to set her hair on fire, banging her heads into, you know, windows, just the viciousness, she knew it was true, that they would, if she dared went to the police. And she just became so depressed over the next couple of years and behavior change and everything like that. And finally she confided in someone and they were able to get these six different, the main leaders of this Asian gang. But they had said that's what white girls were for.
Yeah, just to be used.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, that's scary to me because, not necessarily to me personally, but it's scary to know that our government here in the U.S. and the government in Europe and so forth is just, you know, they want to be so nicey-nice to all these refugees, and they don't care about the native population. They don't care about the white people here. They don't care about the white people in the U.S. or Canada or Australia, where, you know, one Muslim cleric about 10 years ago had said, well, what do they expect? You know, does a mouse expect not to be chased and eaten by the cat? Well, what does a woman expect? If she goes around without a veil on, then she should expect to get raped. And that was like a high-ranking Muslim cleric.
Right, right. That's what they were put out there for, to serve that purpose.
Yeah, and so that's like the attitude that these people have coming into our culture and coming into our nations. And then you got this Paul Ryan who is wanting more refugees to come into our country. I thought it was interesting that, speaking about refugees, the illegal immigrants in this country, they're not necessarily referred to as refugees. They're like undocumented workers.
Undocumented workers.
Stuff like that. But there was a story here. What was it? A 64-year-old woman?
A 64-year-old, and she was an Air Force veteran. That she had been attacked while she was, you know, safe at home in her house asleep, and they had broke in with a claw hammer and basically almost killed her. They left her for dead eventually, and after they had torn up her body with this hammer, they raped her.
Yeah, they like broke her eye sockets and her neck and just everything. And she did.
Yes.
She did eventually die.
And they left her for that. But it took her days to die in a hospital.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that they don't care. It's not, unfortunately, it's not just older women that have had a life. They're going
right
after your children.
Right.
And it's happening night and day.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, the guy that actually killed her, raped and killed her, he had been arrested 6 times in the last 15 months prior to this woman's rape and murder. But he was never taken out of the country or anything like that. He had been arrested in 2014 for felony drug and sexual assault charges. And when the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, ICE, when they had issued a detainer for this guy, the Santa Monica Sheriff's Office said that they would not honor it because Santa Monica was a sanctuary city.
Yeah, because, you know, we couldn't make them feel bad.
Right, yeah.
So we're just going to let whatever these monsters are doing do with their thing.
Right.
And then they can come hang out with us.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people are unaware about the sanctuary cities, but it's basically a municipal government that the mayor or city council or whatever votes to say that they're not going to follow the rules of the federal government or the rules of the state, and that they don't care what the immigration rules are. If you're in their city, they're not going to comply with any federal or state jurisdiction or rules of detainment or anything like that. And that's kind of like, to me, pretty two-faced, because isn't that what, you know, back when we had laws against integration and interracial marriage and against, you know, desegregation in the schools, and everything was segregated and society was a lot more straightforward and civil and so forth.
Everything had its place and we all kept an eye on each other.
Right, and, you know, and the state said, you know, you can't come in and tell us how to run our state. And then the federal government's like, oh, yeah, we can. We're going to march the, you know, National Guard in, and we're going to force you to do what we want you to do.
Right.
And they took the people and the states to task over that and ruined a lot of people's lives as a consequence. And now we've got cities saying, oh, well, we're going to be sanctuary cities, and we're not going to abide by the federal government. And does the federal government come in there with the National Guard, or does the state come in with the National Guard and say, oh, yeah, well, this is our immigration law, and you're not going to allow to do this, and we're going to bust all these, you know, immigrants out of here? No, because they really don't care.
The millions of dollars that are spent on the border to try to keep immigrants out, and these, you know, cities are going, oh, well, just come here.
Right.
I mean, they should just fly them straight to them.
Right,
you know, put them in a little camp there, and they can watch them, and they can quit raping our veterans.
Right, yeah. The governor of Texas here about 3 weeks ago, he said that the state of Texas would no longer take any of the Syrian refugees into their state, that they were not going to be a destination for Syrian refugees. And the federal government came in and said, well, we don't care what you say. we have jurisdiction over you, and we already have refugee contractors in your state, and they're already finding out where they want to put the refugee camps, and so we're going to do it anyway. So it's like, it's, you know, the federal government, I don't even know what to say. It just, it's so screwed up. It's like, okay, if it's for white people, then we don't want to help, but if it's against white people, then we'll help. If what you want to do, you know, sanctuary cities, well, obviously that's against white people, so we'll leave it alone. But when it's for white people, as in Texas, saying, no, we won't have Syrian refugees, then the government's like, oh, wait a minute, it's anti-white. I think we better step in.
Right, right. So, like the special funding for that or something.
Yeah, so, I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's municipal or county or state or federal or what. It's just, if it's good for white people, then obviously, according to most of these government entities, it's bad. And right. If it's bad for white people, then, oh, well, it's got to be good for the country.
Right.
And, you know, when people say there's no such thing as white genocide, I mean, when you look at just cases like that, I don't see how anyone, unless they're just a complete total moron, could think otherwise.
Right.
That there's not, you know, some sort of, you know, planned, you know, Joe Biden said, oh, white people are a minority, absolutely, in 2017. And everybody's like, oh, yay. If that's not, you know, that didn't just happen by accident, you know. It's not like Asian people got on a boat and came here on their own volition. It's, you know, the government's right. That's bringing them here. But back to these sanctuary cities and the rape and murder of this elderly woman, you know, the Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, he had tried to put a proposal into congressional language at the end of the year here for the spending bill that just came up to end giving any money to cities who are sanctuary cities. Basically saying, if you're going to be a sanctuary city, then the U.S. government is not going to give you any money. No grants, no extra financial support or anything like that. And Paul Ryan, he's supposed to be this great conservative. He's all outraged about Donald Trump, you know, women talk and stuff like that, but he didn't allow that language to go forward. So he'd rather side with sanctuary cities, which allows illegal immigrants like the one that raped and murdered that lady. He'd right. rather allow that to happen than to risk being called unfair to illegal, you know, immigrants or undocumented or whatever.
What gets me is they have all these census. They have all the stuff that we easily have to look up online. They
right.
have it at their disposal. And one of the things that you pulled up was a 2011 report that said that these were, they were criminals. They were attached to the alien population.
70,000 sexual assaults by illegal aliens.
And they knew this.
Yeah.
But hey,
right.
let's just get a few more in just in case 70,000 isn't enough.
Right. You know, and we were talking about, you know, the moms holding their daughters by the hand and so forth. You know, this other thing that you found I thought was interesting. It was a study put out by the Wall Street Journal that showed America's missing persons by age, race, and gender.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting, if I'm looking at this right, that 60% of the missing are white people, and under 18, 70% white people under of those missing under 18.
Right,
it's
right.
70%.
And unfortunately, it's male and female.
Right.
But if you look at any other race, it's, you know, those all drop well below 30%. It's,
right.
And this isn't something, you know, you and I sit here and create this fund.
Right.
This is Wall Street Journal. I mean,
right.
It's huge.
Just looking at the different statistics. And, you know, so this shows that there is a huge issue in this country of missing teens, white teens. Some of them have run away. Some of them are caught up into sex trafficking and so forth. The MS gang out of Salvador is very, very prevalent, in especially up in the East Coast, but a lot of Midwestern rural areas. Unfortunately, we don't have that around here, but I know of many instances up in Iowa. Personal knowledge of young girls have been taken by MS gang and recruited and forced into drug trade and things like that. And they're preying on our young people. And, you know, white people are taught to be colorblind and not look at race and just look at a person's content and character, and they're shamed into recognizing differences and so forth. And they're, you know, taught to, you know, not to have any fear and just, you know, I was reading this thing the other day, and it was supposed to be a contemporary view of the Good Samaritan story in the Bible, where it's the Samaritan that comes by and helps this person and so forth. And I'm not going to get into a Bible deal about that, but anyway, but some of these teenagers were asked to rewrite the story in a contemporary view, and I was like, God, these people are idiots, but they don't know any better, because a couple of them rewrote the story in contemporary view, and this one girl was like, her story went something like this. There's a young girl, she's working at a Catholic Charities hospital, and she went out to her car late at night, and she had a flat tire, and her professor came out, and she was like, oh, can you help me? He's like, well, no, I can't. I've got my good suit on. You know, sorry, and I'll call someone for you. And then somebody else came by, a respected person. Oh, this person couldn't help her either. So then a gangbanger with dreadlocks came up, and she was scared of him because his pants were way down low, and he had gold teeth, he had dreadlocks, and he was like, looked like he was a gang member and everything. And so she was like, been taught to be fearful of them, and kind of, you know, even though her parents hadn't necessarily said be fearful, she just knew by society and watching TV that she should be scared of this guy, okay? So in the retelling of the story, then she says he come up, and then he was like, ended up he was like just the most perfect guy, you know, he helped her, and he was like, hey, yeah, I'd be like, you know, where's your tire at? I'll change his tire for you. And he was just like the most good Christian young man. And then she felt like really guilty after for prejudging him because of his dreads and gold teeth and his baggy pants and all that. Oh. And I was like, really? This is the retelling you have of the Good Samaritan. Well, in the Good Samaritan story, it was gangbangers and robbers that, you know, beat this guy and left him on the road anyway. So instead of her, like, thinking, oh, wow, this guy came to my rescue, she should be like, let me get the hell out of here, because he's probably a gangbanger or a robber or a thug, and I might end up in the back of someone's trunk somewhere and passed around at someone's midnight, you know, gangbanger party somewhere. But this wasn't a story that she told from experience. This was just her imagination and her imaginary story in the retelling of this story for contemporary audience. But, you know, the thing is, there's so many people that think like that.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's just, it makes me want to vomit.
Well, know? because now no longer are, you know, gangbangers and drug dealers and illegals bad, because that's the white person.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was
right.
The white professor that was no good. And it was a white professional that was no good.
Right.
But hey, let's put our daughters out there, because gangbangers are going to help you change tires.
Right, right. And anyway, so that was just really, really outlandish to me. That, you know, she, you know, and I'm not just going to, there's a couple guys that came up with a similar type deal, except, you know, it was gangbangers. One was a drug dealer that came to the rescue. I'm like, really?
So they're really teaching them. Not only are they doing the diverse thing with the color, they're like throwing in the criminal aspect of it also.
Yeah.
That it's okay.
Yeah, it was absolutely mind-boggling. But anyway, you know, instead of this girl, you know, sitting there and going, oh, I better not prejudge. Don't prejudge. Don't prejudge. Oh, I'm just a guilty white girl. I shouldn't be thinking like this. You know, instead of thinking about turning around and running because you got this, you know, guy that looks up to no good coming towards you, And, you know, that's how people are taught to think nowadays. In reality, she ought to be carrying a gun and been able to protect herself, you know, because that's not a practical experience, you know. That's not reality. That's not what happens in real life.
No, your daughter plugs the tire,
yeah.
gets back in the car, makes sure her gun's sitting next to her,
right.
and drives home.
Right. And, you know, and there's a lot of women that are beginning to learn self-defense. They are beginning to purchase firearms. I know that a report put out by the Gallup poll, that the NRA reported on, the Gallup poll looked at statistics and polled people around the country and everything, and they found a 23% jump in firearm ownership from women between 2005 and 2011. And even this past year, while they don't have all the data, you know, finally compiled and everything, they're still seeing that trend continue. But they said that 30% of concealed and carry and related merchandise that's being manufactured is being done so with women as the consumer.
Right.
And so everything from handbags with places to put your, you know, your handguns, little compartments and so forth, to specially made bras that can hold your handgun, and, you know, just different. Women have to have different places to hold their guns than a man can, you know. And
we have to have room for the diapers and the gun.
Right, right.
And so, you're right. They have other places to conceal them. They're even making them pink, just
right.
so, oh, okay, that'll look cool, because
right.
sometimes if you're going to defend yourself,
right.
you want to look good doing it.
You want to look good doing it, right. But I also thought it was interesting that 42% of the women that have a gun have at least three guns.
Right. Well,
because you have to accessorize.
I know. Now we're getting back into the typical woman, but, you know, you can't have the wrong gun with the wrong purse, because sometimes that little pocket for that concealed
right.
doesn't fit. Or
right.
you might be going, like, you know, into a larger city, and
right.
you want it in the inside
of
your purse.
If it's wintertime and you're going out shopping and you're wearing a big coat and your boots and your jeans and you're all bundled up, then you might want to take a .45. If it's in the summertime and you're going out to eat somewhere and you got a little sundress on, then you might want a 9mm in your little purse.
Right.
So it
right.
kind of depends.
You know, we laugh about this, and you know me, every once in a while I just kind of run away and have a weekend to myself. And I was talking to another lady who was traveling alone in a hotel lobby, and she had mentioned the locks on the door.
Uh-huh.
And I told her, I said, I agreed with her, except
right.
I also travel with a gun.
Right.
Every woman should travel with a gun.
Right.
And she kind of had these excuses. And to me, there's no excuse, because it was like when we had taken our
concealed. The guy at the counter in the hotel can't make another pass. Just like the key card you have.
Right, right. He can't be the one doing it either. I mean, it comes from everywhere. When you and I took our concealed carry
yeah.
class, you know, the police officer said, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Right.
And, you know, if you're sneaking into my room in the middle of the night, I'm probably not going to be sorry.
Right, right, absolutely. And so, I thought that was, you know, good news, just the fact that, you know, more women are starting to conceal and carry, and, you know, it's, you know, the feminists and liberals, they talk about empowerment all the time, empowerment, empowerment, you know, it's like every other headline, female empowerment, and then it's like, oh, wait, but don't have a gun. It's like the best female empowerment in the world is to be able to blow some guy's
you
head
off.
You
stand up for yourself, but don't hurt anybody doing it.
You know, some thug that just broke into your house or is trying to hurt you or your children or something like that. I mean, that's empowerment. You know,
right.
it's being able to defend yourself.
Right.
We just have a couple more minutes left, but I thought this was interesting, was that there's a meeting held recently up in Michigan, and it was held by an organization called the Foundation for the Marketplace of Ideas, And our attorney of the Knights Party here, Jason Robb, he's on the board there. But what I thought was interesting, they had a pretty good turnout there. The main director of it is a guy by the name of Kyle Bristow, and he's an attorney. He's a good-looking young man. He's been profiled in numerous papers around the country because he, I don't know if you remember, Sherry, a number of years ago in Texas, they had the illegal alien roundup at a university.
Oh, right.
He helped organize that. A lot of similar different events like that around the country. But what I thought was interesting was that in part of his law practice is that he represents victims of revenge porn.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Revenge porn, I was explaining it to someone today who had never heard of it, but revenge porn is, well, first off, let me say, don't let people take naked pictures of you. I mean, that's like, I would think, a no-brainer. But anyway, so this would be like boyfriends or husbands or whatever, and sometimes they don't know what's being done, but, you know, for the most part, they probably do.
Right,
but
right.
They take these pictures or video, and then they put them online and share them with other people. And, of course, you know, these are intimate moments that are meant to remain private.
Right, right.
And so, they, you know, these, you know, different boyfriends or husbands, they've done this in order to ruin women's credibility with their families or other boyfriends or their jobs or college or just a lot
of
different things like that. And there's actually, you know, websites that specializing in hosting revenge porn.
Oh, my goodness.
Which a lot of people have tried to get taken down, and they kind of hide under the First Amendment and so forth. Even though, you know, the consent to be photographed is not the consent for others to share in that.
Right, right.
But I thought it was interesting that this attorney, because they want to try to make it out, you know, the media likes to try to act as if the white nationalist movement is like anti-women,
right?
And we know for a fact that it's not. I mean, there's so many women that are involved in the white nationalist cause, and the men that are involved are very supportive of any women that are in leadership roles and so forth. But, you know, we all want to work together to help the white race. But I thought it was interesting that part of his law firm's what they do is to represent victims of revenge porn, and he's been very successful at it. He's won a number of different women upwards of $500,000 for being victims of some of the really heinous, you know, revenge porn out there. And so I thought that was just kind of interesting because it does show that, you know, the people in our cause and our movement are not by any means anti-woman. They're very pro-woman. And I've always, you know, I've always found that.
Right, right.
You know, that men are very, the men in our cause are the most pro-women men that are out there. Now, they're not for abortion, but that's because they're pro-women, and that means they're pro-women babies, too.
Right.
And they're not pro-gay and things like that. But, you know, for the most part, that's, you know, the women, you know, Christian women or women that are becoming acquainted with Christianity and so forth, just wanting to, you know, reunite with the, you know, religious traditions of our people and so forth. They find that our movement is very pro-women. We want women to be able to own guns. We want women to be able to be safe in the streets. We want women to be able to be safe in their homes, not to be exploited. Just, you know, everything that we do is pro-family. And pro-family means pro-women.
Right.
And, you know, and it also means pro-man, too. So I'm not saying that it's, you know, in preference of women over men, but I think you'll find more of the old-fashioned chivalry alive,
right? And it's not a suffocating dominance. It's helping women as much as we build each other up.
Right.
They help us be stronger as
right,
well.
Right, absolutely. So anyway, well, we are out of time today, Sherry. So I don't know if you have any last words or anything other than go buy a gun.
Yeah, go buy a gun. Well, I would always say go buy a gun. Right. And you should buy it in pink, too.
Yeah. Buy it in pink, make sure you accessorize, have a couple different calibers and so forth. But just reminding everyone again about the European American Heritage Festival in Pulaski, Tennessee, this weekend, October 22nd, all day long on the square. It's a small town. It's on the courthouse square of Giles County, so you don't really need a map or anything. Just go to Giles County to the courthouse square. There's going to be white heritage booths and food and live music and displays and t-shirts available and just all types of stuff like that. Bring your lawn chairs and just plan to hang out all day long and fellowship with other racially conscious white men and women and families and teens and kids and just the whole bunch of us. So do that, and you can go to whiteheritagefestival.com for more information. And then finally, just to sum up the show this week, it's just that we want to remind our white sisters out there to continue to educate yourself about the issues. Don't let others do it for you. You know, it's important that you know what the issues are yourself. Don't rely on what other people tell you the issues are. Educate yourself so that you can, you know, if you're a mother, that you can, you know, impart information to your sons and daughters. If you're single, you can be the one that your girlfriends come to for advice and information and so forth. Just be that person that is aware of what the issues are. And then always finally just remember that it's your duty as a daughter of Christ, of a daughter of God, to be courageous, to be brave, to be strong, and to always do your part. So until next week, I'm Rachel Pendergraft.
And I'm Sherry Makings.
And we're wishing you well, and remember to always keep your white pride.